Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, listeners, and welcome to the New Books Network's special series, New Books and Celebration Studies. My name is Emily Allen, and I'm your host for this episode. For our episode today, I am talking with Neil Shuster about his book, Radical Ritual, How Burning Man Changed the World, published by Counterpoint Press in 2019. Written from Neil Shuster's perspective as a journalist, student of American culture, and six-time participant in Burning Man, Radical Ritual presents the event as vitally historically important. Shuster contends that Burning Man is a significant player in the avant-garde, forging new social paradigms as liberal democracy unravels. In a wonderful mix of narrative storytelling and reportage, Radical Ritual discusses how Burning Man has impacted the art world, disaster relief, urban renewal, the utilization of renewable energy, and even the corporate governance of Google. Neil Shuster has been a correspondent with Time Magazine, television critic for the Miami Herald, and editor of Atlanta Magazine. He's taught at Hampshire College, Boston University, and George Washington University. So, Neil Shuster, thank you for joining us for this episode of New Books and Celebration Studies.
Thank you, Emily. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Great. Yeah, we're happy, excited to have you. So before we get into the book, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? Like, for instance, how did you first get involved in Burning Man?
Sure. Well, my wife got us involved in Burning Man. I would never have gone on my own. And 7 years ago, some friends of ours, I now live in Washington, D.C., and some Washington friends were going, and she said, I'm going, and yeah, you can come or not come, but I'm going. So I, knowing Burning Man only by its reputation for outlandish sex and abundant drugs, I said, well, I'm not going to let you or allow you or permit you or whatever. But that sounds horribly chauvinistic, but I'm unwilling to suffer as you go alone, so I'm coming as well. And it was quite extraordinary. So I went as a reluctant, accompanying spouse, I guess is the best way to put it. But once I arrived, I was just very much taken up with what was going on, both as a reporter and a student of culture, but also as somebody that thought, wow, this is just a very, very cool place to be. And at the end of the first visit, my wife Kate was quite frustrated, and she was mad. I said, why are you mad? She said, well, you didn't even want to come, and you ended up having a better time than I did. So that's how I ended up at Burning Man. I've spent almost all of my career as a student of American culture, either as a reporter of American culture or occasionally as an academic. And I just thought that Burning Man was the most amazing specimen of culture that I had ever really encountered. And so we happened by chance, just the honest coincidence, we wandered into the camp that the founders of Burning Man were at and ended up making contacts with them. And I was talking about how I thought it might be very interesting to do a book about aspects of the Burning Man culture that would translate into the outside world. And that turned out to be just exactly what they were interested in those days, and still are very much so now, the organization. And so one thing led to another, and I embarked on the book, and they gave me great support. And 4 years later, 5 years later, a book came out of it. So that's the version of how this book came to be.
That's great. You probably had no idea that when you went, all that would just happen.
None. I mean, Kate kept saying, you know, I think you're going to write about this. I think you're going to write about this. And I didn't at all think I was going to write about it. And then the fates conspired to keep putting pieces in place. And the more I got into it, the more I just thought that this was not only a terrifically wild celebration, and I've traveled a lot in my life, in my career. I've been to many, many places, and I still maintain that Burning Man is the single most interesting place I've ever been. And it continues to be so for various reasons. The art that's going on there, the formative social patterns that are taking shape there, living out on the desert for a week and a half, all that stuff just makes it an amazing place.
Yeah, and we'll get more into that in a little bit, kind of like the experience of Burning Man. But, you know, kind of still building our foundation for the listeners here, you started talking a little bit about, you know, how you kind of initially got into the book process itself. But can you also tell us a little bit more about how it was actually writing the thing for you?
Well, it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my career. It was the most satisfying thing I've ever done in my career. For a long time, I didn't for a good while. So I just started doing it. I said, I'm going to do it. I didn't have anything else on my calendar. So I just started, you know, slugging it out. And writing any book and writing a piece of nonfiction reporting is a steep uphill climb. And I think I was probably 2 years into it, and I didn't really know if I had anything there. And finally, I was in a car driving from Washington to a funeral in Philadelphia. And the first line of the book shoved itself into my brain. And the first line was, nobody saw any of this coming. And that is now the first line in the book. And that, you know, the musicians, composers often talk, well, you're a musician. But I've heard a lot of popular songwriters, Dylan says it, and I heard Gordon Lightfoot say it, that they don't know where songs come from. They just seem to show up. And that line sort of showed up. And that unpacked much of it for me. That got me going. And then the other thing was, I still didn't have that got the ball rolling. And the other thing there's tremendous frustration when you're writing something and anything, and you really often wonder if you're going to get through it. And sometimes it can be as short as a 800 word column. And this one, I think I was continually confronted with those kinds of frustrations, and I came up with a mantra for myself, which was just pick the low-lying fruit. Whatever shows up right now, whatever you can write about right now, just take it, and it'll lead you to the next stage. And so I that was the other great insight I had into writing a book as multidimensional as this one. That I'd feel stalled, or I'd feel like I really couldn't go further, or I was getting anxious about whether I really had all the information I needed. And I just say, all right, what do I, right now at this moment, what can I say that I know? And that got me through a numerous, you know, potential writer block moments. And then the other thing about writing this book was I have never before had the opportunity in my career to do like four versions of a book. I wrote it once, and then the agent kind of asked for some rework. And then the editors wanted some rework. And then in the copy editing phase, I can't say enough about my publisher, Counterpoint Press, out of Berkeley, California. It's an old school sort of book publishing that it doesn't exist anymore in most places. Where you, it's sort of a boutique press run by a guy who had an eminent career in publishing, and so I got a chance to keep polishing and polishing and polishing. And by the end, I read the book now maybe three or four times cover to cover. And the thing I like most about it is generally when I write a piece, after it gets in print, you'll say, I wish I hadn't said that, or I wish I'd used this word or that word. And reading this book, it feels like it's pure silk, you know. So that was a real luxury to be able to have that kind of chance to just keep buffing and buffing and buffing. So it was terrific. It was and the other thing I really blew me away was how much you can find on the internet now. You'd be at a point where you'd want to know about how do you construct a yurt. You know, a lot of folks live in yurts out there. And, you know, I'm 74, so I came of age, you know, in the old days. And, you know, you'd have to go on a yurt expedition or something. But now I could just look up yurt and spend 20 minutes and finding, you know, you'd find enough information so that then you could distill it into that one kind of a positive phrase or something, whatever you wanted to use, and the reader wouldn't even know that it was, you know, the product of research. It doesn't sound erudite, it doesn't sound pedantic, but it's just the right word or just the right image, and that was terrific. The internet has made life so much easier, and the same with interviewing. I kept trying to get into Google, as you mentioned in your intro. Google has a very, very strong connection with Burning Man. And I had very good connections into a lot of the, you know, into Schmidt, and the two founders of Google are very much into Burning Man. So there were links I could, you know, I kept trying to exercise because I wanted to interview them, and they just, I couldn't get into the company. But what I was able to do on the internet was find a dozen interviews or discussions or speeches that Paige and Brim gave. And thus I could kind of watch them and then report them as if I were in the, you know, as if I were in the audience, and I could use I could find stuff that I needed from that experience. And that was terrific. I mean, the internet has liberated writers, I think, in a way that I hadn't fully appreciated before I started doing this book. And then, you know, Wikipedia is just the treasure of treasures, because every question that you have, you can at least fake an answer by way of Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah. And if they don't have it, then they'll have resources linked where you can find it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, every time they have a fund drive, I give money, because I could never have done this book without them. So I'm just, grateful. But that's how I did the book. I mean, it was hard. My wife, I think, was frustrated about 2.5 years into it. And my son never took it seriously until it sort of came out. But voila.
Oh, I bet they take you seriously now.
I'm not even sure of that. But
fair enough.
But she's very proud. And the New York Times asked me to write a piece a few weeks ago on virtual Burning Man. And that was a great career, you know, high to do an op-ed in the Times. And that gave me some street cred in my household.
Oh, I'm sure. And we'll actually come back to the virtual one in a little bit as well, in terms of, you know, how that has changed as well. Still kind of big picture questions here. Based on your experiences, you know, in all these different areas, really, who do you think some target readers for this book might be?
Well, I believe anybody studying American studies or interested in cultural history or interested in popular culture would find this book fascinating. It's shameless of me to say, but I've heard it from other people, so I'm just repeating the fascinating one. I don't know if you'd agree. And then you've got the burners, and it's a huge community of people that have been to Burning Man or want to go to Burning Man or heard of Burning Man and wonder what it's about. And I think I've heard from other readers as well that this book is it's a very, very comprehensive kind of treatment of what Burning Man, how it became, what it is, its various aspects. And I think the best praise I got was the Smithsonian in Washington had an art show. They gave away, they mounted a massive show about Burning Man. And when in its last days, they staged a day-long symposium. And I was asked to give the concluding remarks. And they wanted me to talk about the future of Burning Man, and I was humbled because in the audience were the people that had started Burning Man. And I mean, I have no special claim to any expertise. And when Burning Man types ask me, well, how did you get the right? What gave you the power to write about Burning Man? I said, well, nobody made me an expert on Burning Man, but I am a pretty good reporter. So I took, I just think I'm a reporter. But here I was at this symposium talking about the future of Burning Man, and I speculated my ideas. And then at the end, one of the eminences of Burning Man came up and he said, I don't know that I've ever heard it put that way before, and so coherently. And that was hugely satisfying. I mean, that was flattering. So, but I think that anybody interested in American culture, particularly now, would find this. I did the American Studies program at Yale, and it just drips through this book. I can see time and time again, I see where I'm putting together my sort of, American Studies stuff into this book. And I think it's fun. People, one of the critics called it a combination of sort of a fun novel and a guide or something. So it has certain novelistic qualities. Did you find it a fun read? I think it's a fun read. Did you think so?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I thought it was really informative, but still like easy to read. Like it, I don't know. I can totally see how your American Studies hat and your reporter hat, I guess, carried through it in that kind of nice balance.
Yeah, that was the fusion. I mean, and that was the single most important person in my, well, one of the single most important people in my career was Tom Wolfe. And I sort of decided to be a writer when I was in high school, and I read a collection of his essays before he even was, a legend. And I just feel that this gave me the moment to kind of pull together all the stuff that a guy like Wolf did, because one thing that most people don't realize about Wolf is he's got a PhD in American Studies from Yale, and he draws on a tremendous amount of historical and academic sort of insight but he wears it very, very lightly. But his work is such a, it's such a quality above almost any other nonfiction journalist. He's passed on now, but it was the Space Book or a lot of his short pieces, because he has this knowledge. And so I actually went to Yale to graduate school because of him as a model. And then I knew I wanted to be a writer, and I got to know him. And the first time I met him, I said, well, I went to Yale because of you, the graduate school. And he looks at me and says, will you ever forgive me? Because I don't know how your graduate school experience is, but American Studies graduate experience at Yale is pretty onerous. And I said, no, I'm not. Well, I'm not sure if I do. And he laughed.
That's great. That's really cool. I can see that makes a lot of sense, actually, the more you're talking about it. I was like, okay, yes, I see it now.
it was a wonderful at this stage of my career to be able to draw on all the various aspects of my work and bring it together in one book was hugely satisfying. I mean, it's sort of the capstone of a career. It was a great feeling to do it.
Yeah. And I think all these different hats you wear, kind of, again, I can see that absolutely resonating in the book. And I guess, let me ask you this too, coming from your positionality and authoring this book, what do you think makes Radical Ritual different than, say, like other books about Burning Man?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it takes Burning Man seriously without being a fan letter or a hysterical kind of pan to it. I'm an ambivalent burner. I mean, I don't know that. I was once asked by somebody I went again, one of the leaders of the organization. The first time they met me, they said, "Well, are you a burner?" And I said, "Well, I don't think so." And then they said, "That's good."
Yeah.
So it makes it different, I think, in that I've read everything that's written, almost everything that's been written. I think perhaps everything that's been written about Burning Man. I locate it in an historical context in a way that I don't think I read in anybody else's work. I think that I have a natural kind of cynicism without sort of resorting to media tropes or knee-jerk sort of cliches. So I'm not blind to the excesses or the ludicrousness of much of what goes on there. And yet at the same time, I'm hugely supportive of it. I think to answer your question, I think this book probably gives a more detached, objective, sliverly cynical, but not conventionally supercilious looking down look at a major cultural phenomenon in the world.
Right. And I think one of the things that always comes up, you know, in anthropology, for instance, is the idea of insider-outsider perspective, you know, what brings to the table. And I think that definitely comes into play with that, like you were getting at.
Yeah, I think that's, I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, I sort of put on masks, you know, not masks. I go in and out. I also wanted to give, there were a couple of chapters where I wanted to give the reader the actual, a retelling of my experience at Burning Man. So, because everyone has a different experience, so you can't say the Burning Man experience. So there's a couple of chapters that were written explicitly for someone who has never been there, just so that they might be able to get a kind of textural feel for what this place is like and what happens and you know what constitutes its existential qualities.
Yes, I definitely got that. I haven't been personally in that those chapters that you're talking about definitely painted the picture of all the spectacle that you experience, you know, in that space, it seems like.
Well, that's what's lost. I mean, that's what's typically lost by people who haven't been there if you only know it from the media, there's a sense of you know, it's naked people running around having sex and getting stoned, and you know, the media has again and again and again retreated to that soundbite, but the spectacle, as you aptly note, is what makes it extraordinary, and not merely spectacle as a participatory spectacle. It's not as if you're going to the carnival and you're watching all this stuff, because it's all done by all of us that are there. Nothing is, you know, and that's a hard concept for people who don't know it or who think it's another sort of Coachella or you know, one of these festivals. You buy a ticket and you watch professional talent perform. It's entirely produced by the people who are there, quote unquote, the citizens of Burning Man or the citizens of Black Rock City. And that's, there's nothing comparable to that in the world, I don't believe. There are other festivals, but on the scale that this is and the magnitude of the ambition of the various participants, the artists, or when somebody's recreating a Boeing 707 out there. I mean, they haven't got the whole thing finished yet. I've seen it unravel in several years. But I mean, think about that. They're building, they're bringing out a 707 into the middle of the desert that they're reconstructing. I mean, that's staggering. I mean, it's just, you can have 25 hits like that a day when you think, my gosh, this is going on here? I mean, how did somebody find creme fraiche in the middle of the desert, you know?
Yeah, I think all that resonates really well in your discussion of kind of how the idea of art or the categories of art, like you said, with that participatory aspect are blurred. I mean, it's expanded almost.
I don't know if you want to get into the nitty gritty yet, but I genuinely believe that the notion of art, which is central, it's central to the aesthetic of the guy who founded the whole thing, started it himself. He's also deceased now, and is the foundation of everything that gets done there, is interactive, because the idea is one is involved in some aspect of the piece. Either you have to tug and pull at it to make it move, or you enter it, or you slide down it, or you change colors in front of you or something. And and I don't believe that anywhere else it's like, this is the Basel of, the Basel of large scale and techno-industrial art. The other thing that makes it extraordinary is the whole Silicon Valley crew is deeply, deeply, deeply intertwined in the work that goes on out there in terms of the interactivity of the art. I mean, some of the stuff, when the guy who died, who founded it, a guy named Larry Harvey, and he died 2 years ago, and he was in charge of, it has since turned into a nonprofit, and it's a reasonably big organization, and it's now 75,000 people come to it every year, and there are offshoots all over the world. So it's an enterprise now, a nonprofit enterprise. But Harvey always kept the specific role of being in charge of the man himself, the effigy that gets burned, the central piece. And there's a long history of how that happened. But the story I'd like to tell right now is upon his death, he was working on a vision of a three-story high wooden effigy of a being, a man or something, that was going to have the technological capability of being able to move and change poses and do that in response to the crowd that was surrounding him. So there would have been visual optics like that. Now that, so you would have had this, if the crowd, it never got too far along, and then he died, and then nobody else, had that kind of crazed ambition yet. But think about that. I mean, think about that quality of fusing technology with humanism, with interactivity. This is the future. I mean, this is, assuming we don't blow ourselves up or whatever. But I mean, if the culture continues to go this way, this is going to be the future, I believe.
Yeah. And speaking of future, that kind of captures the essence of that, the Burning Man that happened this year, right? Like with the online multiverse.
Yeah. I was blown away. I mean, I was blown away. I wouldn't have, I don't think that I would, I mean, I had the Times not, I got one, I got an email one day from one of the editors in the op-ed section, and they said, we were sitting around talking about how the COVID has affected so many different things, and Burning Man came up, and we said, I wonder how Burning Man's going to be affected by this all. And then they knew my book, and so they asked me to write a piece about virtual Burning Man. And I don't know that I necessarily would have even looked at it. I would have gone online to look at it had I not had that assignment. But then I got involved in it, and staggering stuff. So they called, Burning Man was canceled in the spring, and there were no plans, and nobody knew what, there was no plans to bring it virtual. There was not, it was just not going to happen. And then, because of the nature of this community and its spontaneity and its independence and its commitment to activity, there eventually 8 different platforms were sanctioned by the organization as being worthy of being lumped together into a site that one entered by way of a Burning Man HTTP. And they were done by different entities. Some were done by whole shops. One was modeled after Second Life. Several were variations of commercial sort of interactive, participatory, artificial intelligence stuff that's going on. One of them was a three-dimensional reality that you wore the goggles with. The one that I ended up going on with my wife was a site where you have an avatar, and we didn't turn ours into anything special, but many people, you know, made very, very elaborate avatars. And then I was really, you know, at a very, what's the right word, early stage of knowing how to technologically navigate this site. I mean, someone that was better would have moved much faster. So, you know, I was moving like a dummy. And so we somehow end up out on the playa, the playa being where all the art is. And we approach a piece of art that people made the art for this stuff. I mean, you could make a piece of art and install it on this playa, you know, digital art of some form. And we're sitting there looking at it. And then there's somebody, and other avatars are also sort of there. And you can see the other avatars. And one had the capacity to talk to a neighboring avatar if they chose to respond to your ping. And so we're out there, and we're talking to some. This woman happened to be in New York City, but I was just astounded by this. I mean, astounded by this as a cultural historian, you know, as a student of technology and culture. I mean, imagine what this is going to be like, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that we will be able to have environments that are attractive to us, that where we can interact with other people. A friend of another burning guy, the guy I write about in the book, I don't remember, the Marine who at the first temple burn I went to, who came back from Vietnam with a flag, with the scarf that he was a Marine and he had killed he had killed somebody. And his friend had been killed, and this guy was suffering, and he had all kinds of problems, and he went to the temple there at Burning Man, which is one of the facets of the place, and you bring your sort of emotional trappings to this thing, and then they burn, and then at the end of the week the temple burns. So some people will bring old wedding dresses, and some people will inscribe letters to someone who they want to forgive or want to be forgiven by. And this guy had brought the scarf from the Iraqi and a flag, one of the flags that they give veterans after they die. And he brought them both to the temple, and he wrote over it to my brother, whom I couldn't bring back home, and to my other brother, who I kept from coming home. And this was like his emotional purge, and he's a very different guy these days. But he had told us about virtual Burning Man, and he was going to the bars because some people had built bars in this virtual Burning Man. And he was saying to us, you know, he would at night he'd go to the bar, and which he, you know, he does the same thing at Burning Man, and he'd go to the bar and chat up people, and you know. Extraordinary. And if in fact we, you know, if COVID heralds a massive threshold, you know, a Grand Canyon in the civilization, and on the other side, it's going to look very, very different and very much more virtual. I think that this Burning Man, virtual Burning Man will rank as a very, very significant historical moment in the development of ways to exploit virtual reality for a humane purpose. I mean, nobody was doing it to make money. Nobody. You know, that's the thing that differentiates Burning Man 2 from the festivals. It's not. When one describes it, it sounds soporific and you know, real sloppy. But in fact, it's true. For a week or 8 days, 10 days, people sort of suspend the notion of commerce. And so what it's replaced by is a kind of, foundational humanity that we all share. And that was what was driving the innovations that were in this portfolio of platforms at Virtual Burning Man. And they were, and I can't underscore enough that the techno wizards of wizards are the one participating in Burning Man. And it's right up, it's up from, Elon Musk has a famous line where he said, Silicon Valley is Burning Man. So the stuff you see out there and the platforms probably partake of that are crazy beta tests of some genius that wants to see if you can make a robot spot a crowd and then with artificial intelligence detect the mood of the crowd and then, respond to that mood. That's the kind of stuff that's going on there. That was a long-winded answer to, I don't know if there was, oh, virtual. Yeah, oh, virtual was very cool. I mean, I suspect it'll go on. I would predict that there will be virtuals now as an ongoing thing associated with Burning Man. And everything went down. It was just like Burning Man in that it was 8 days and then all the platforms were taken down. So it was a real, it was an ersatz experience like that.
Yeah, that must have been really fascinating. I was just trying to, I haven't gone to any kind of large events online yet this year, but I kind of want to just kind of see what it's like compared to, like the Mardi Gras stuff, for instance, like what that would be like.
That'd be fascinating. Think about that one. I mean, you could create a Mardi Gras. I mean, it could be simulated and the music, people could program their music. There was music playing on this site that we went to in this virtual Black Rock City. People had chosen to put, there were certain places, they had markers in the ground. And if you went to that marker and triggered it, you'd hear music. And some of them that somebody had put together. And a couple of them had avatars. There were stages set up. It's mind boggling. It's just mind boggling. For someone that kind of looks at culture through a telescope or something and wants to kind of get a sense of where it's evolving and stuff. And that's one of the things that just, I've been blown away by Burning Man. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, just to try to define for myself what this culture was about.
Yeah, and speaking of the culture here, you kind of started getting at this a little bit in there when you were talking about how, it wasn't for money and kind of getting at the values of Burning Man. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that in terms of, in this culture, what are some of the key terms and values?
Sure. Well, there are 10 principles to Burning Man, and there's a long backstory about how these principles came to be. But essentially, when one enters, they're not regulations, they're not prescriptions, but they're sort of expectations and descriptors of what goes on here. So some of them are leave no trace behind and everybody is welcome. And I mean, your default is to bring somebody in. So somebody, but there's also a commercial one, which is phrased in terms of decommodification. And these principles were compiled by the guy I was talking about earlier, Larry Harvey, the one who was designing the dancing Burning Man. And they sort of reflect a fusion of San Francisco bohemianism and the last vestiges of the 60s culture, the hippies culture, in that there was a sense of a communal capacity to sustain and support and at least in a short period of time enable people to display their best sides, as it were, to display their most creative sides, their most artistic sides, their most humane sides, And in keeping with a sort of an elaborate social ideology, it was a repudiation of capitalism and commodification. And one of Harvey's compelling ideas was that we live in a culture, we live in a society where virtually everything is commodified. You know, you pay to watch entertainment. Your role in life is very much defined by structured expectations that are associated with some kind of cash payment or social status or things like that. So this was structured as a decommodified world. Nothing is for sale in this. You can't buy anything. Now, the only thing you can buy is ice because it's mandated by the state of Nevada. And there's a kind of a big coffee center because there was a tradition right from the beginning when there were only a dozen people that went out into the desert of always having a pot of coffee on the, there was always a pot of coffee on a fire. Other than that, there's nothing you can buy. So you bring your stuff, and if you need something, you borrow it, or somebody gives it to you. And gifting is the notion of gifting is also central to this culture, and the idea of gifting is that all of us have some gift we can give. I mean, it can be something like making a piece of art, or it can be being a storyteller. Or, you know, just having a sympathetic ear for somebody. And so gifting is going on all over the place, all kinds of wonderful things. The bar I was talking about, for example, on Playa, this camp, whoever they are, you know, would have brought all the liquor, et cetera, and it was all free. I mean, you know, it was free. Then they built the bar. They're wonderful music. There's a bluegrass area, there's a jazz area, there's an orchestral area that form, people come with their instruments and form the Burning Man Army, the Black Rock City Orchestra. And all of this is construed as a gift. It's a gift to the community. The performances are gifts to the community. Yeah, and the notion of keeping it clean and keeping it... making sure that no trace really is left behind. It's when I come back from Burning Man, I find myself for the first few weeks back in Washington. When I see a piece of litter on the street, I pick it up. I mean, it doesn't last forever, but it's like, this is our collective environment and the collective environment I've just been in for the last 2 weeks where we all have stake in it. You don't litter. And I'm walking down the street in Washington, and this is my environment, our environment, and people, there's litter, and I'm going to pick it up, you know, maybe who knows what, maybe someone will see it and do it too, but it's that kind of a thing. And a big element is the decommodification. People will, if you rent a U-Haul trailer, people tape over the U-Haul logo on it and stuff like that. People, there are various entrepreneurs and companies who try to do things at Burning Man. You know, they wanted to introduce a product, or they wanted to underwrite a stage or something like that, and they just refused to have any of it. So for another model that is going on here is a model of decommodified interaction, and nobody would suggest that that can be done in the real world over a long period of time, but to see it underway in a short period of time can shake loose a lot of truths that you've held as inviolable, and suddenly you see that there's an alternative way to organize life. And various, yeah, some people take the plunge. I mean, I write a bit about that in the book too. People who decided that they were going to change their lives, and some would work in Burning Man, and others just decided they didn't want to be a corporate lawyer anymore, and stop being a corporate lawyer. On the strength of the experiences they had at Burning Man. The other thing is, it's an environment where you have tremendous numbers of experiences, and because of the physical environment, because of the social environment. You go deep into yourself. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes it's liberating. But you find out constantly that the person you thought you were, or the person you took for granted when you walked through the gate, isn't necessarily the only person you can be. And that can have a real stunning effect on people. For some, it's the disintegration of an ego, and breakdowns are not uncommon there. and others, it's a kind of transcendent ambition to do something much grander than they've previously done. And, you know, there are not spaces like that in the world.
No, not many, at least.
Yeah, I mean, not many. I mean, there are spaces, but I don't know. I mean, really, truly, I mean, you know, you can go to one of those, what do they call, personal transformation workshops, right, or something, or perhaps, you know, there are organized religions that offer this alternative, Outward Bound. But the idea that every year there will be this event, and with so many different dimensions to it that ultimately lead back to the self, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is. And all this came from one person you keep mentioning, of course, Larry Harvey, right? And can you talk to me about your relationship with him? And, you know, you were getting at this at the beginning, but towards the end of the book, you talk about like his memorial service. You know, at that service, how did people close to Harvey describe him and his values that fed into Burning Man?
Well, my relationship, I probably had a half dozen extended personal conversations with him. He was a very complex guy, not an emotional reader, and it wasn't that he was not warm. It was that he was really socially distant. So he was a complicated guy. I go again in the book. There's a lot of backstory, but I think the first time I met him, I started working on the book, and one of the people who was in charge of public relations and communications at the organization was a very, very powerful ally in the book. And Harvey was coming to New York to talk at Columbia, and I was going to go up and hear him, and then we were going to meet the next day, and that was to be our first meeting. And at that point, I wasn't even sure I was going to do the book, and I couldn't do the book if he didn't. He had to want to do the book with me, and if he didn't, then it was hopeless. And so we go to a coffee shop after it on the next day, and he's. I just felt like I was blowing the whole interview. I mean, I've been a reporter my whole life, so you know I know how to schmooze an interview, but it just wasn't working. And then at some point, it came out that we both had a child the same age. We both had a 35-year-old child. And it was funny because that became and then that got us talking about fathering. And that was what opened everything up. And I think there's a sense of that in the chapter about the memorial service. At the end, it was his son who gave the final kind of benediction over the whole event. He was a big time, in some ways he was a sort of a lost soul until Burning Man. And Burning Man was the anchor to his whole life. He was a visionary, and people will say that. He would see things that others didn't. He believed in the potential inherent in the collective coming together of all these people, that it would indeed transform ultimately all kinds of things. He was very political, not conventionally in the sense of party politics, but he made enemies internally and allies, but he wasn't a saint. But he was respected as he enjoyed extraordinary respect. At the end, when Burning Man became a nonprofit organization in about 8 or 9 years ago, and in that form, they had to have a lot more. Up until then, it was a private LLC that Harvey and about 4 other people sort of owned. But it made, you know, they didn't make any money. And all the money they had went back into the event. The event costs, I don't know, $20 million a year to throw, maybe something like that. The number's very big. And until very recently, I don't know where they stand right now. And I know that not having the event this year was quite devastating. And there's been a lot of fundraising, and because it basically runs on its cash flow every year. And the savings or the accumulated capital is indeed rather negligible. But Harvey was the guy at the end when they became a 401c3, and they had to have a more official board, and they had to run their books a little differently and everything. And it was clear to everybody that Harvey was not the guy to be the CEO of this organization. So they create, and he came to accept that. And they created an entity for him, not merely a position, called the Philosophical Center, and he was the chief philosophical officer. And that sort of speaks volumes of what his role was. He was the house intellectual. He was the guy who who read lots and lots of books. He used to bring him, a very shy man, and he used to bring books to Burning Man, to the event itself. He had an old Airstream, and he would bring books to read at Burning Man. And as somebody said, who brings books to read? You don't read at Burning Man. I'm an inveterate reader. And I don't read. I mean, I'm reading all the time. I don't read a word at Burning Man. But Harvey was, he was that kind of guy. I'm very, very sad that he didn't get to read the book. I am very sad because in part, I was writing the book for him. And there was a time when I didn't know this book was going to get published. The New York publishing houses, this was a few years ago and before the big Smithsonian show, but they had a whole cop-out attitude about Burning Man. Burning Man on the West Coast is perceived very differently than it is on the East Coast, although that's changing now. But on the West Coast, it's understood to be, a crazy show, but something to be taken seriously. On the East Coast, it was, all the disdainful sort of images that I mentioned earlier, they were just too hip for that. So I didn't think the book was going to get published. It was turned down for a while by various houses and stuff. But at one point I told Harvey, I said, listen, I'm writing it. I'm into it. I mean, this is my art project. I'm deep into it. I'm going to finish it. And if nothing else, I'll give it to you, and it can be reside in the Philosophic Center, and it'll be a resource. So so I really was, to this day, as I talk to you, I'm sad that he never got to read it, because I would have loved to have conversations. I would have loved to see what he thought about it, and then I would have loved to be able to keep talking to him about it. But he's not around.
Yeah, no.
but his successors are, and it's going to be interesting to see what it'll be like under his successors. And the actual man, the running of the organization, he was not involved in after the last 5-7 years. The event was run. His sole role was to, as I said, to choose the man and to oversee the man. But there was an organization, depending on how they come through COVID, that ran everything, and they'll do just fine, assuming everything's good. The question's going to be, where the intellectual firepower is going to come from. And there's a guy that was sort of his wingman, as it were, and he's now in charge of the Philosophic Center, and he's a good man, and it'll be interesting to see, what he ends up doing. But Harvey had the magic dust when it came to reading the mood of the times and being able to energize the crazed ambitions of artists and those who were comfortable around artists.
Right, totally. That's awesome. Yeah, really, it would be interesting to see what he thought of the book. And then, like you were talking about with the online, event.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Well, he probably would have. I mean, my hunch is he was not techno. I mean, he was anti-techno. and the last burn that he oversaw was this artificial. The reason why he had this Burning Man that was going to dance was because the theme of the last burn. He also came up with the themes of each burn. Every burn has a theme. And the last one was going to be artificial intelligence. And that was the last theme that he had contributed. And he was quite concerned that the Silicon Valley types couldn't wait to have chips put in their brains. You know, the metaphor that we're all going to have chips in our brains and we'll be able to do all kinds of extraordinary things. And as the convergence point or whatever that's called, where the biological and the technological fuse. And that to him was an awful proposition. So I don't know how he would have handled virtual Burning Man. He might have loathed it because what he really liked is the press of flesh, you know, the kinds of emotional things one has. One thing about virtual Burning Man is you don't have those emotional ups and downs that I was describing earlier, which are so fundamental to the experience of being there. I think my intuition is he wouldn't have liked it, but he was enough of a realist and, you know, he would have understood that. He would have figured out a way to use it to his ends and the ends of his vision.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. What else are you working on these days?
Well, I mentioned to you earlier, I've sort of shifted over to the piano and I'm trying to learn how to play jazz. And now I wanted to do a book. So the book was finished and I wasn't sure what I was going to do next. One, I wanted to do a book on mind fucking, on what happened with Cambridge Analytica and what's going on right now with all the manipulation of social media for the sake of mobilizing people that don't know they're being mobilized. And I sort of started looking at that for a while, and then that didn't come off. And then I was thinking about doing a book from inside organized baseball. I had contacts that could have brought me into Major League Baseball as it tries to figure out a way to straddle this tradition and the romance and the sort of sentimentality that baseball occupies in our cultural space with the business reality of it's not capturing young audiences anymore, and it no longer is so and I was going to look at it from the point of view of the chief baseball officer who loves the game but is also part of the organization, and then that was I think essentially too political a topic for this guy to let me write about. Okay, so then I just said, well, you know, I'm going to just play the piano. and then COVID hit, and I thought, well, I'll just make some, I've been working on an, it's so pompous to say it, but an autobiography, but it's really positioned as a letter to my children. So I write it as something that I have three children, and I work at that for a number of years, and some of it's not bad. And then when COVID hit, I thought, well, I'll do a chapter, you know, Notes from a Season of the Siege. And now I think I'm into that. Now I've been working on that for the last few weeks, and it's got some momentum right now. So I'm kind of doing a daily take on what seems to be in my mind at the moment, at each day underneath the siege. We've left Washington, and we've lived since June on the Delaware coast, and in a not isolated, but a very, very simple town setting. And then the convergence of the siege with, you know, with Trump and this election. So I've been writing about musing as a cultural historian about the moment in time, as it were. So I don't know if anything of that will see the light of day, but I'm still writing.
Oh, good. That's good. I understand. Well, yeah, that's all very timely work. That's for sure. And if it comes to the forefront, I'll look forward to.
Oh, well. Make sure you get a copy, Emily. It's been a pleasure chit-chatting with you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Neil Schuster, for joining us on New Books and Celebration Studies.
I have enjoyed every minute of it, Emily. Thank you so much.
Good. And listeners, we appreciate you as well. And as a recap, this is the end of an interview with Neil Schuster about his book, Radical Ritual, How Burning Man Changed the World, published by Karen Boyd Press in 2019. This is Emily Allen, and I'll see you next time here on New Books and Celebration Studies, a special series from the New Books Network.